We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Audacy put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Audacy. Visit ads.audacy.com.
Bernstein and Rahimi, 9 a.m. to noon on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
We love the All-Star break because it allows us to branch out into things that we can do just because we want to. And I really wanted to do this, and that was talk to Emily Nemens, the author of the wonderful baseball novel, The Cactus League. She is on Twitter at Emily Nemens, and she joins us on the Score Hotline presented by Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. You can also join into the conversation and watch on Twitch here at twitch.tv/Chicago670 The Score. Emily, how are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. I have to admit, I had no intention of reading this book. And my parents gave it to me, and they said, read this book right now. And I said, really? I said, it's a baseball novel. I don't like baseball novels generally because so many of them are bad. And they said, well, this one isn't. Read this. And I said, well, the last one you recommended was The Art of Fielding. And I guess that was pretty good. So I'll read this too. This is so much fun. It really is. And I just, where and why? How did this book find you? How did this idea find you? How did it come out?
Oh, thank you. So I'm so glad you liked it. The book is about spring training baseball. I made up a major league team named the Los Angeles Lions who come out to Scottsdale, Arizona every spring to get ready. And part of it came out of just personal interest in baseball and the Cactus League. I grew up in Seattle and I'm a Mariners fan. And I didn't go to Arizona every year, but I went often enough to just fall in love with the possibility of spring, the opportunity to watch really, you know, sort of rough and tumble baseball, to be candid about, you know, sort of those rough early games of the spring and get to know the new team, get to know prospects, and just be up close and personal with your team down in Arizona. I think, you know, growing up playing, watching baseball in the Kingdom, there was also some like really visceral shock of showing up in Arizona when it's, you know, 80 degrees and sunny and you're watching baseball outside. So Arizona and spring training always had this magical sort of aura around it for me. And I just loved it and wanted to spend some time in that world. The other thing I was really interested about in the Cactus League is almost every baseball book I've read, and I've read some good ones and I've read some not good ones, to your point, is about the end of the season, you know, that last at bat or the World Series or some other pennant chase. And I wanted to think about the very beginning of the season before there's those sort of natural narrative drivers of who's going to win everything. Where are the other moments of tension? Where are the other stories that can make a really exciting game and move these characters forward?
Well, that to me was one of the most compelling parts of it, was the idea of understanding how many people are truly a part of your day in baseball. And you take the approach of not just focusing on the stars, but you focus on everybody who's around the game, even one of the vendors and the stories that they have.
The organist.
And I think that that's really key, because we've talked about vendor shortages and you don't realize you miss the people you miss sometimes. And you took every single aspect of it in a manner that interlinked all the stories.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for saying that. You know, I really wanted to think about the baseball team as a community, right? And the baseball stadium as a small town. There's a book called Winesburg, Ohio by Sherwood Anderson that did this great, you know, a century ago. But, you know, what if the baseball stadium is this community center and it's not just Jason Goodyear, the Los Angeles Lions, you know, generational left fielder who is coming into the stadium, but it's the vendors, as you said, it's the minor league batting coach. It's, you know, the organist coming to warm up at the same time as the rookie. And they're interacting in the parking lot. They're watching each other and listening to one another and thinking about, or maybe not thinking about, maybe not thinking enough about one another and how one's actions and one's efforts can impact their whole community. So, you know, it was, I started with individuals and wanted to set up sort of a constellation of people who represented a wide range of that community. But then one of the most fun things to figure out was those connections and, you know, sort of drawing lots of dots between people, erasing some of those lines, making some of the lines curvy or, you know, a few loopsy loops as well. But thinking about how we're all connected on this space, I say we, you know, how this baseball team is all connected, but how those connections really, I think, do mirror even a fan's life as they walk into the stadium.
It's almost like you're reading my notes, Emily, because I wanted to talk about the literary structure, the narrative structure of this book, which fascinated me, because in some ways it's almost it is loosely a novel, but it's also a collection of vignettes, and it's held together through the device that you use of the sports writer, who provides a different voice and has a little bit of omniscience, but not total omniscience, and who's simultaneously in the story and outside the story. And I wrote down Our Town by Thornton Wilder. And I was I was mindful of that play, that sort of the meta theater of Thornton Wilder's Our Town, and how the stage manager in Our Town functions very much like our sportscaster guide, who's a part of this, but is also explaining things to us and giving us historical lessons, you know, geological historical lessons. But that I thought was sort of a parallel here in the way it's structured, that we have the person helping us who's inside the story and outside the story.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think Our Town was like sort of in the very back of my brain because maybe it's been 15 or 20 years since I encountered it in school. But absolutely, I did, because there are so many people and there are so many stories, I felt like this book needed a little bit of guidance, you know, to move between narratives, to jump, you know, between time frames and perspectives. And I had this idea of almost like a Greek chorus coming in between acts and explaining what has happened and predicting what might happen next, and thinking about, okay, it's 2011. This voice that comes in between acts knows more than anyone else on the field. They have access to things that no one else has access to. And as I'm sort of enumerating the parts and the characteristics of this voice, I just thought, holy cow, I have a sportscaster. And you know, my research for this book was all sorts of a grab bag, and I was kind of a magpie between, you know, I interviewed an organist for the Boston Red Sox, and I did a lot of research watching documentaries and long-form journalism and, you know, box scores, of course, and going to Arizona several times. But one thing I did when I was in graduate school in Louisiana was sit in on the 2012 LSU Tigers season. And I had a press pass and was at sort of the edge of the press corps, doing a little bit of reporting for a local magazine there, but also really seeing how the structure of sports journalism was working during the Great Recession, during this sort of scary moment for sports journalism, and how sports journalism operated during this time of crisis. And I didn't know at that time in 2012, I didn't realize, oh, the narrator of my book will be a sports journalist. So when I put that together, suddenly I had all the pieces and they fell into place.
It does seem like it was a sports journalist who was writing it, because even focusing on a minor league batting coach, when we always joke that batting coaches, they themselves joke that they are dead men walking, to focus on that story is one of the narratives in this, I think, is just an example of the detail.
Yeah, I really, you know, there is a superstar at the center of this book, but I really wanted to sort of do a point counterpoint of athletes and everyone who's holding them up. So that was very intentional and took a lot of nuance to get it right.
We're talking with Emily Nemens, the author of the baseball novel The Cactus League, which has been on bestseller lists everywhere and best of lists wherever you want to find it. If you're a baseball fan, you'll really enjoy it, especially because you use real touchstones there. When you mentioned the pink pony, we're like, oh, sure. When you mentioned Don and Charlie's, you know, we can feel Don and Charlie's, those of us who have covered spring trainings and those of us who have been there. What I really want to know, though, how did you research all of the intricate baseball wife stuff about the psychosocial hierarchy and everything that was going on there? You've got to, you know somebody or you know some people, because that stuff is just too real. How real was the research there?
I watched a lot of reality TV and, followed the WAGS hashtag on Instagram for quite a while. There was one bad season of Baseball Wives, which is set in Scottsdale. Pete Rose had a very short-lived reality TV show called Pete Rose Hits and Misses, MRS. I was actually looking at reality TV sort of historically, academically at one point early in, several years ago, and was able to sort of understand the way that these characters are presenting themselves publicly, what's going on in their personal lives. And it wasn't just reality TV, but that definitely gave me a head start. And I think, having grown up in Seattle, lived in New York, lived in Louisiana, lived in New York again, and then traveled to Arizona, I have a little bit of a sense of what it feels like to relocate and try to set down roots and build new family communities. And, even if your husband has the biggest contract in baseball, leaving all your friends to be at a new home or staying home when your person is gone for 6 months of the year is hard. It's lonely. And I wanted to, both be a bit critical of some of the more conspicuous consumption and cattiness of this community, but also be really empathetic about the challenges that they face in terms of trying to raise a family, large, not entirely solo, of course, but often independently, and some of the other challenges of just being thrown into a new world every time your husband gets traded.
Okay, so now I have to ask, what was the most entertaining part about watching those shows for your research?
I mean, Pete Rose's one was interesting because they weren't married yet, and it was kind of a train wreck of a season. the whole premise was that he was living with his fiance, and like in episode 5, it turns out like he's still married to someone else at the time of the of the filming. The opulence in Scottsdale, having driven between stadiums and explored some neighborhoods and doing all the hiking. And I, I'm an architecture nerd, so I was definitely going up to Taliesin West and all of that. But in terms of the Baseball Wives show, some of those gated communities, some of the opulence of these 5, 10, $15 million compounds. Just as a baseball fan or someone with a rental car, you might not be able to see that. But I was able, you're a fly on the wall in those shows. And so that was fascinating.
There is a lot of architectural description, a lot of intricate, and there's also a lot of detailed description of bodies. A lot of it, a lot of the baseball players' bodies, how they're built, what they look like. And you talk about the women being very honest about the wives or the girlfriends and everybody else. So there's I found it wonderfully descriptive as you talk about the way people and things are built.
Yeah, thank you. That's probably the art and architecture historian in me. I have a training in professional describing of art and architecture. And so I think I actually had a lot more of that in my draft, and my editor was like, you go a little long in the descriptions, Emily. so cut it back. And I did. I cut back about maybe 25,000 words.
Wow. Like just, wow.
I know. The descriptions were really crazy at one point, and I'm so glad I did cut it back. And I think it really helps with the momentum. But, you know, if I have five sentences describing a character, can I do it in four? And the answer is usually yes. And it's not the first four sentences. It's, you know, all five, but compressing them in a more dynamic way. So, you know, taking a descriptive impulse, but then also making it fun to read is just, I know you guys probably didn't sign up for a craft talk this morning on how I build sentences, but that kind of works.
I appreciate
all along
that.
The way.
Yeah, English major here, so believe me, I'm.
Yeah, I'm okay. Great.
You've come to the right place.
Excellent. And then, you know, in terms of the architecture and, you know, the building of buildings and the buildings of bodies, you know, I think baseball is, of course, you know, an intellectual sport, but it's still always a physical one, right? And performance is so tied to how our bodies are holding up and mm-hmm. and. On the field, of course, but even for, you know, the coach who was historic, you know, had a playing career before he was a coach, he doesn't need to still have that physical prowess, but he also can't disengage from it, right? And it's still part of his identity to have that strength. And so, you know, the same way I built a constellation of different roles within the stadium, I wanted to sort of think about different kinds of bodies, different kinds of strengths and weaknesses and insecurities and confidence, right, around performance.
I have a friend who's a screenwriter who was really proud of a baseball movie that he wrote. And everybody, and he shopped it around, and everybody said, "This is great. We can't make it. This is great. Love it. We can't make it." And so, well, this actor is going to do it. It's like, doesn't matter. We can't do baseball movies anymore because of the overseas dollars and because of so much box office is so global. Like, you don't see John Hughes American High School movies made anymore because India right. doesn't understand the idiom. Are the rights to your book optioned? Have you had any similar headwinds?
Well, I will say that I just sold and the book was published in Italy, which I was fascinated by because certainly they don't have a huge baseball culture, but, I've already got some Italian fan now. So I found that heartening that even if there's not a baseball culture abroad, I'm connected at least with that audience. It has been optioned. I'm a very, nervous Nelly and a bit superstitious, so I don't want to talk too much about it,
okay.
But it has been optioned, and I think because it does have all of these, you know, interconnected stories, it sort of would be a natural conversion to like a limited series or something. And I'm certainly hoping for that, and I think it's in good hands. So. Ask me in a few months.
I will. Well, I mean, look, I'm a member of the Screen Actors Guild in good standing. So if you need a voice,
oh,
or if you need a grizzled sports writer or sports caster or somebody just flipping hot dogs, I'm there for you at union rate.
Excellent.
It's one of the few organizations that he's actually in good standing with. No, I'm just kidding. But I also want to shout this out before we let you go, and that is. I saw that it was part of your, originally it was a master's thesis at LSU for you, and it turned into this great work. How did that happen?
Thank you. Yes. Work. You know, I had a story collection at LSU. I was in grad school and working full time at the Southern Review and wanted to write these stories about baseball. And so it did start as those vignettes that you pointed out earlier. And all these characters, and I thought it was great, you know, it won like the thesis prize. I got an agent based on that story collection. But everyone was like walking past each other and bumping into one another, and the stories were taking place concurrently but not acknowledging each other. And, you know, Jason Goodyear was already out in the left field already, but it wasn't connecting as much as it could. So I went back and I looked at these stories and realized I did have a through line sort of staring back at me, looking at me in the face. And so I reoriented everything to sort of think about, you know, what would happen if their generational player, if this $100 million investment had a bad season and everything went sideways because of this one character. And, you know, some people's stories changed a lot and some people's stories only changed a little bit, but I was able to revise and sort of reorient the vignettes and the real momentum of the whole book towards that overarching theme of what's going on with Jason Goodyear.
Well, I'm glad I read it. I urge our listeners who are baseball fans to read it, too. It is called The Cactus League, and Emily Nemens, the author of that book. Thank you for taking the time to join us today. This was great.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Thanks, Emily.
That's Emily Nemens, and it's a quick read, too. This is not some massive book. This is it's a great summer beach read, travel read, just something to have. And I think my wife's going to read it next, and then my son's going to read it when they go to the Jersey Shore in a little while. We want to celebrate a Chicago baseball anniversary.
We're a couple days late, but don't worry about that.
Because you were kind of part of the fun of it. So I want you to remember it.
I can do that. You know what I'm talking about, fam. Let's revisit Quintana next.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
You could travel the world, but never come close to the goal.
Well played, Jordan Malley. Well played. That's one Katy Perry.
Of course it is, because her name was invoked 4 years ago as part of the breaking news of the Jose Quintana trade.
Let's take you back to a different time. It was 2017. I was younger. I think technically we were all younger, working at NBC Sports Chicago, and it was the All-Star break. And during the All-Star break, we had this really cool tradition, definitely pre-pandemic type of money thing, where we would do some sort of summer outing as a group. And I was super excited to go on the architecture cruise because I've never been. I've still never been. And my boss at the time, Kevin Cross, said, "Hey, you live close. You like these type of things." And I'm like, "Yeah." He goes, "Can you be on standby if there's any breaking baseball news?" And I'm like, "You know it." Like, I was like, "Oh, I'll be fine. I'll still go on the architecture cruise. Nothing's going to happen." Famous last words. The trade of all trades went down. So we find out that Jose Quintana is not just being traded by the White Sox, but to the Cubs of all things. And the Cubs were giving up, as we know, a really decent haul in return at Dylan Cicely Jimenez. Mm-hmm. So we find out as this is developing that it was broken on Reddit. And my boss and I were talking it through. Kevin Anderson was in the office at the time. He was our coordinating producer. And I said to Kevin, "Can we say these names on TV? The names of the Redditors who actually said the trade."
And by the way, they're scrambling on the other side of the glass here, because as we're going to replay what you said, we cannot actually play the names of the Redditors. So they're,
kids. See, I work blue around here.
They're cleaning it all up for our actual broadcast airwaves.
Okay, so let me take you through the process. You know me. I like to lean into the awkward. And I didn't have a problem with it as long as my bosses didn't have a problem with it. And I'm like, "Yeah, dude, let's do this." So I workshopped it a little bit in advance on the Twitter, if you will. And I said, "All right, guys, I'm going to say these names on air." And then I started to notice, or I said I was asked to say these names on air. And we were laughing about it. I was laughing about it, the process out loud as we were getting ready for the show that evening. And I noticed that it had gotten like 40,000 views in about an hour. And for me, that was massive. Like, that was huge. And I'm like, "The people want me to say it." The people want me to do this. I am going to be there for the people. We take one for the team around here. And I did. So on Sports Talk Live on NBC Sports Chicago, I leaned into the bit and said things that I can't say on this radio station.
When they told me at the office that I would be the one saying these names, as you can imagine,
better you than
I
me.
Threw a party in my head, and then I told everyone on Twitter about it. So here we are, kids. It is my pleasure to say that it was two Reddit users, WhatButt23 and Katy Perry's Booty, who first discussed the trade on a White Sox subreddit, Wednesday night. We have pics. Take a look. Katy Perry's booty posted. I heard from a friend whose brother's friend works for the Cubs that Q is going to the Cubs in exchange for four players. Has anyone heard anything similar? I feel like this starts to get a little Ferris Bueller. And then a source jumped in, WetButt23 said, four prospects, no pros, players were meeting with doctors and will be official tonight or tomorrow. Again, on behalf of Chicago sports fans, people who love a good joke and watching people like me have to say these names out loud on TV, props to Katy Perry's booty and WetBud23.
Go crazy!
Yeah!
That happened.
It did. And we all had an excellent laugh. Apparently, that clip was played at the general manager's meetings nationwide for our regions. I found that out.
For what reason? Just for fun or to say, don't let this happen?
On the contrary, they thought I was cool. Didn't matter much. Still got laid off in a pandemic. But as I joke, that might have been for the Jim Boylan, Robert Horry comment. It wasn't for that either. I'm kidding. These things just happen. But yes, apparently it was appreciated by the fellow regents because I was leaning into the bit. And then you guys played it on the air. And I was like, why did you have to bleep me out?
Because our rules are different. Your cable, it was different. And how about the fact that both GMs, or both the guys who lead both baseball teams, at the time, Theo Epstein, president of baseball operations, and Rick Hahn, also, said, well, I'm no WetButt23 or whatever it is. I forget exactly what it was.
That was the best part. That's what
props to Katy Perry's booty.
But that's what we don't realize. That was the best part about all of this. I don't mean to sound super cheerleader here, but similar to Ian Happ telling us about the need for Chris Bryant to cherish it, Billy Madison style, where you grab somebody's face and shake it. The idea of cherishing the All-Star game. We had to cherish this because it was the biggest trade in baseball. It happened in Chicago. We all know how it ended. But the fact that two of the biggest GMs in the game not only made the trade, but then leaned into the weird with us was the best part about all of this. They were in on the joke. We were all in on the joke together, and then they joked about it in their media sessions. It doesn't get much cooler than that.
And it still leads you to wonder, who knew whom, and independently that these two Redditors would get correct information one way or the other. Is this, obviously it's, there's no way of knowing, but it just, it will probably never quite happen that way again for any of these, but they had such advanced knowledge and it makes you not rule out stuff that you hear.
It was absolutely awesome. And the coolest part to me was, we were all in on every part of it. It started in town. People talked about it on a Reddit board. Their names were hilarious. We acknowledged the names, then said them proudly on TV. And then the general managers of the two of the biggest teams in baseball said them too.
And then we can talk about the trade itself, which was Quintana traded to the Cubs for Bryant Fleet, Matt Rose, Dylan Cease, and Eloy Jimenez.
We're waiting on Eloy to come back. Dylan Cease is still a work in progress. Yeah, we're still going to talk about Dylan Cease on the show. Because we're not really making trades.
Yeah, I'm still waiting to really validate, for me to really believe in Dylan Cease. I'm not quite there yet.
He's pitcherish.
Yeah, the traits are there. The curveball, I love the curveball.
His stuff is great. Can he harness the stuff?
I don't know. And Brian don't know who Bryant Fleet is, and I don't know who Matt Rose is. Maybe they're great, and I should know who they are, and I just don't, and I don't apologize for that.
And frankly, fans still talk about who won that trade. Who won it? They still argue about, was it the Cubs who won it or the Sox won it?
Sox won it.
And I argue that if you have to think about it, that means it was a good trade for both parties.
We have the Midday Midway coming up next. I have an incredible story about an iconic piece of Americana once thought disappeared that was recently accidentally discovered. And I mean an iconic piece of Americana.
Wait, what?
That they thought it was gone and somebody just found it in a bag in an office.
I have a story about organs being mixed up after they were installed.
What?
Mm-hmm. Yours is cooler. So that's next. Also, everybody, the anniversary was 2 days ago, but I still say you can celebrate it. So Do something fun today on me.
Wet Butt 23 and Katy Perry's booty.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
The first half or the second half, you know, it's they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
9, 10.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel it.
The Midday Midway with Bernstein and Rahimi. Middays 9 a.m. to noon on The Score.
Time for the Midday Midway, which means we tell you what we've done so far. And we started out talking about Allen Robinson and the Bears and sort of what could be behind the fact that it's very improbable that a deal is going to be done between Allen Robinson and the Bears before the deadline this afternoon. Is it 3 o'clock or 2 o'clock? I always forget whether it's Eastern or Central. Either way, it just looks like they're not. And we were trying to hypothesize the reasons why. And I tried to sort of flesh out when I do my Matt Nagy mind meld and I sort of get in his head and try to think like him, it's scheming guys open. It's not necessarily about how much you pay for the individual. It's the magical scheme should be enough. Now that the quarterback is here, it's all going to work.
Yeah, because how's that scheme worked out so far?
Bad. But I'm just telling you that he is a true believer. Ian Happ was really good talking about the break and talking about the team and sort of the psychology of both Chris Bryant and Wilson Contreras and what they've been talking about for the second half. Emily Nemens joined us. She's the author of the baseball novel The Cactus League, which we broke a little news. Apparently the movie rights have been optioned and she didn't want to talk about it because somebody does apparently want to make the movie out of that. Good luck to them. And she was really fun talking about the book and her process and everything else. And then we revisited the anniversary of not just the Quintana trade itself, but Layla deciding to go on television and have as much fun as possible saying the names of the Redditors involved.
And I still never got to go on the architecture tour.
Go ahead. It's right down here. Enjoy. Go. You can take a day off and go tour architecture.
I know, but you know, I've been running around town, like watching a lot of baseball and eating and stuff. Yeah, that's it, really. So you'd hope that if you had to get an organ transplant, that not only would it go well, but that you would survive. And you don't really think about the things that go into it because you trust doctors, as you like to say, Dan. And I'm not trolling in that statement. It just seems like a reasonable conclusion.
I told you shouldn't trust doctors.
You know, I don't understand why you always want to trust doctors. I can't.
Because we went to medical school?
Don't worry about that. Years of history. Anyway, this story is not one of those stories. In Cleveland, an organ transplant recipient got a kidney that was intended for another patient.
Ooh.
Kidney! That's not good. However, the kidney is compatible and the patient is recovering as expected, while the other patient's transplant, unfortunately, is delayed. The hospital says the mix-up is inconsistent with their commitment to helping people and wants to ensure it never happens again.
The hospital said this is consistent with our policy where we just spin the wheel of organs. What?
I'm glad they at least acknowledged it, though. Like, thank God it came out and was news. The full statement from University Hospitals is this. The University Hospitals transplant program is comprised of a highly qualified multidisciplinary team of experts with decades of transplant care delivery and research experience.
And this trained opossum.
Yeah. Pan over to the possum and he's like, oh, little hands in the air and just doesn't know which kidney to put in someone.
What about Danks?
Just in life, really. We're dismayed that an error recently occurred, resulting in one patient receiving a kidney intended for another. This kidney is compatible. The patient is recovering as expected.
That's just dumb luck that it's compatible.
My God, yes it is. Another patient's transplant surgery has been delayed, and that's the real tragedy there. It's not just the other person, it's the person who is waiting on the organ. We've notified the United Network for Organ Sharing, UNOS, the organization that manages the National Organ Transplant System. We are also carefully reviewing the situation to understand what led to the error and to ensure that such an event will never happen again.
Good.
And there's a little bit more to it than that, but at least they admitted it. And at least it was reported. Because that's how you acknowledge stuff like this.
I just wonder down the list.
Don't
like
hide
if,
it.
If they have to move this person up in priority now, there's somebody else. Like this affects everybody else on the list. when you screw up one of these.
Yes. That part of Grey's Anatomy I watched is actually in real life true. That there is a list there, which is why we should all be organ donors if we can be. Do the right thing.
This is from KIRO7. That's Seattle, right?
Cairo.
For nearly 50 years, rumors swirled about Catholic University of America regarding the alleged presence of an authentic piece of film history. Even Matt Ripa, lecturer and operations coordinator for the university's drama department, had searched extensively and unsuccessfully for the blue and white checked gingham dress worn by Judy Garland as Dorothy Gale in 1939's The Wizard of Oz.
Because the ruby slippers are at the Smithsonian,
I've seen them.
Right?
Yeah, I've seen them. Yeah. I've seen the ruby slippers. This was reported by Smithsonian Magazine. The dress, reportedly gifted to the Washington, D.C.-based university in the 1970s by a former drama department artist in residence, had vanished without explanation until Ripa noticed a nondescript bag on top of the faculty mailboxes while prepping for renovations. I was curious what was inside and opened the bag. Inside was a shoebox, and inside the shoebox was the dress.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. So my coworker and I quickly grabbed some gloves, looked at the dress, and took some pictures before putting it back in the box and heading over to the archives. Needless to say, I found many interesting things here during my time, but I think this one takes the cake. And they've got pictures of it. Her name says Judy Garland written in on the seam. It says, according to the university, the dress had been gifted in 1973 to Reverend Gilbert Hartke, the storied head of the drama program, by actress Mercedes McCambridge, who's from Joliet, actually, Academy Award-winning actress, who had served as artist in residence in 1972. Ripa said it was fitting the cinematic memorabilia resurfaced in the building bearing Hartke's name. They said that the circumstantial evidence at the moment authenticating the costume is strong, noting that McCambridge and Garland were contemporaries who were believed to be friends. Garland died of an accidental drug overdose at the age of 47, 4 years before McCambridge's donation. It's amazing. They've got it. Like, could you even imagine were this to be auctioned? I think it's got to go to the Smithsonian because you're talking millions and millions and millions of dollars in value here. If this thing were to hit the auction block. Like, that's the dress from Wizard of Oz.
And then immediately I think some Russian oligarch is going to buy it because that's what happens. And then he just has it, like, hands it to his daughter and is like, you're not in Kansas anymore.
Put this on. Things will be all in color.
It's like that dude from the DirecTV commercial in the Grand Palace.
Yes, with the throne.
Like, but I also like savings the money. I love that commercial. So that's who's going to buy it otherwise.
Do you know from where...
With the tiny opossum doctor in his hands.
And even if they haven't seen, what is it, the... I'm trying to remember the famous Mercedes McCambridge movies. I think she was in Giant.
Oh, dang.
I think there
That's
was...
That's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, I forgot what her Oscar win was. But I will tell you, do you know where she is? Where she's probably best known, even though people don't know it's her work?
What's that?
The Exorcist.
Oh.
By the way, All the King's Men was before when she was acting for Orson Welles is probably her most famous. But
Texan is still coming through, by the way.
She is the voice of the possessed Regan McNeil in The Exorcist.
Oh, that's weird.
It's not Linda Blair's voice. Linda Blair, who was who actually played Regan McNeil. Not possessed. Or maybe. That's a different version of the movie. And The Exorcist went, dang, is possessed by the demon Pazuzu. Hey, Chicago!
I won't watch that movie.
But vomiting mustard on everybody.
Wait, what?
But actually, Mercedes McCambridge, who supposedly changed, she was uncredited and then was mad that she was uncredited and wanted credit for it once it started getting nominated for all these Oscars. But she does an amazing job in that movie. And apparently she chain smoked and she was gargling eggs and she was actually bound. Like they actually tied her hands and feet so she could struggle against everything.
Gargling eggs?
Yeah, for the vomit scenes and like for post vomit. She said it was like mushy apples and raw eggs and stuff. Like she did full method acting to try to get in character for the demon Pazuzu.
Couple texts because
I still like
really
the possessed
funny.
Bag.
That's hilarious. 773. Regarding doctors, just don't trust the ones that walk in to a room and say, "Hi, everybody."
Hi, everybody.
And then also 773. In Russia, which lands on house?
What am I supposed to do with this crucifix, Chicago? Whoa.
Gosh, So did you watch The Exorcist? Have you seen that movie?
When I was in sixth and seventh grade, I was obsessed with it. And
what?
I loved it. I wrote a paper on it and for horror and the uncanny in reading seminar, and my friend Dave and I did a whole like Siskel and Ebert bit with film clips as a big presentation about certain horror movie convention. We did scenes from The Omen, we did scenes from The Exorcist, and scenes from An American Werewolf in London.
This totally makes more sense as to why Ruby the tarot reader drew the devil card for you.
It's not the devil though, it's Pazuzu. She says it's the devil, but it's not. It's the locust demon that was originally happened upon by Father Merrin at a dig in Iraq.
Huh?
That's why you hear the buzzing when he's staring at the statue of Pazuzu, because that was the demon of the locusts.
Either way, it's all coming together.
I gotta watch that again sometime. It's so good. Well, that's the Midday Midway, which we do most days around this time. And coming up next, baseball talk with Matt Spiegel here at the All-Star break, although his childhood favorite team is back in action tonight in a game I'm not going to watch. Because I don't want to.
Nobody should want to.
Because A-Rod makes you stupid. Spiegel makes you smart.
Exactly. More Spiegel.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.